From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Passover is right around the corner, and over the next few weeks, hundreds of thousands of pounds of matzah will ship to grocery stores everywhere. A few batches of this plain-tasting cracker always sell out first because they contain shmurah matzah. What's that you say? Jean Barron reports.
The pressure is on at the Manischewitz Baking Factory in Newark, New Jersey. This is the day Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz, dressed in a white overcoat and wearing a grimace of joy and stress, oversees the production of shmurah, or watched matzah. All matzah is bread made without yeast, but shmurah matzah is guarded by the watchful eyes of a team of rabbis from the field to the oven. Their job? Prevent any trace of water mixing with the flour until the last minutes before baking.
The very basic of kosher matzah rule requires that it goes from the mixing area to the oven in less than 18 minutes.
Jewish religious leaders say 18 minutes of contact between flour and water is about as long as you can go before fermentation sets in. A few religious leaders are on hand at the industrial bakery.
Are we ready to start the process?
Yes,
taking a cue from Rabbi Horowitz, two rabbis give a blessing, press a button next to a silver mixing cauldron, and watch.
Yes, limit. Yes, that's it.
Rabbi Simcha Katz says shmurah matzah stands out in his childhood memories.
I remember going to the Boston Rebbe. A group of people of us, young people, were rolling it, and then the rabbi himself put it into the oven. And watching it, and said, wow, this is really exciting. And that matzah had a special taste.
Simcha and the others watch the high-tech machines press out a ribbon of dough. Suddenly, an official matzah maker opens a gate on the conveyor belt, and just-cut squares of dough fall into a trap right before they go in the oven. The rabbis say these matzot are not up to snuff.
The matzahs are going to trash. They're torn, they're broken, they're folded over.
This is, you see, it's like double. It's not baking good. Да, проблемы залипают. In few minutes we'll be okay.
Soon the familiar squares are rolling again. Manischewitz and other matzah makers bust out as much as 60% of their product line in the weeks before Passover. High stress?
Very. Very.
That's Manischewitz head of sales, Kevin O'Brien.
I refer to it as, for me, it's PPS, pre-Passover syndrome. In layman's terms, it's like our Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, and Hanukkah all rolled into one.
Manischewitz shmurah matzah is heading to Seder tables from Canada to Argentina in the coming weeks. As for the matzah dough that didn't pass muster, it'll end up in animal feed. For NPR News, I'm Jean Barron.
The District of Columbia has become the sixth jurisdiction to allow same-sex marriage. Before the doors to the Marriage Bureau even opened this morning, more than 100 couples were standing in line to apply for licenses. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports that for those who happen to be Catholic, this is a bittersweet moment.
It's a familiar script.
God won't hear what you say when you pretend to pray.
A handful of religious conservatives damning gay unions as an offense to God. Soon their protests were drowned out when the first batch of couples emerged from the D.C. courthouse. They stood in front of microphones, euphoric that they can now marry. But for Catholics like Philip Dunham, there was some ambivalence.
I didn't go on Ash Wednesday for the first time in years, and I really felt like I didn't belong anymore.
Clutching the hand of Alan Pittenger, his partner for the past 9 years, Dunham says he's long felt snubbed by the Catholic Church. But the final straw came when Catholic Charities in Washington, D.C. stopped handling adoptions so that it would not have to place children in the homes of gay couples. And as of yesterday, it stopped providing spousal benefits for all employees, lest the organization give benefits to a gay spouse. Pittenger and Dunham see these as cynical moves.
Now they don't have to provide any type of benefits for anyone going forward.
And they can blame us. When I read that, I thought, wow, it's a great way to save on payroll costs, blame the gay community, and come out smelling like a rose.
They say the Catholic Church in other places, such as San Francisco, found a way to accommodate gay couples. The Washington Church simply didn't want to. Not so, says Susan Gibbs, a spokeswoman for the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C. Given the Catholic Church's history of social justice and fighting for working-class wages, this decision was wrenching for the church.
This has been really hard for Catholic Charities and for the Archdiocese, because we are so committed to working with the poor, it's what we do.
Gibbs says the church had no choice. The D.C. government redefined marriage. And so Catholic Charities was forced to choose between keeping its contracts with the city and abandoning its belief about the holiness and purpose of marriage, in which a man and a woman unite to have children.
Really, the priority was how does Catholic Charities continue serving all the people it does now while meeting the requirements and staying true to who they are as a Catholic organization.
But Father Joseph Palacios, an openly gay priest affiliated with Georgetown University, says the new policies were, quote, written by the lawyers.
The church will find itself in increasing isolation with its own Catholic community.
Palacios sees this particularly among students, a trend that was captured by a recent poll of Catholics under 30.
The millennials who identify as Catholics are thinking of themselves as increasingly spiritual and rather less Roman Catholic.
Which translates into fewer people in the pews, he says. Of course, some conservatives from other denominations have flocked to the Catholic Church because of its harder line, suggesting that the battle over marriage and theology will be messy for some time. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News, Washington.
Jesuit priests are widely admired as scholarly, witty, and even being a little debonair. They've sometimes been known as God's soldiers after being founded by St. Ignatius of Loyola in 1534. But would most of us really want to live like a Jesuit, with a vow to adhere to poverty, obedience, and, well, you know, chastity? Maybe just a little. Our friend, Father James Martin, a Jesuit priest, associate editor of America, the Jesuit magazine, and a very funny and fine man, has written a new book, The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything, A Spirituality for Real Life. He joins us from the studios of Carnegie Hall in New York. Father Martin, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Scott.
Help us understand a phrase you return to in this book, God in all things.
Well, that's a shorthand understanding of Jesuit spirituality. As you say, the Jesuits were founded by St. Ignatius, and his idea was that God was not confined simply to the walls of the church or to just sort of prayer or reading scripture, that God could really be found in all experiences in your life, and that every moment of your life was an invitation to meet God. And part of what I talk about in this book is how to meet God in different parts of your life, in work, in relationships, in simple living, in all sorts of things.
You know, there's a new film out, Brooklyn's Finest, about cops there in New York. Contains one of my favorite current lines about spirituality, where one of the characters complains in the confessional to the priest. He says, "Damn it, I don't want God's forgiveness. I want his help." Is it wrong to make a prayer practical? Is it greedy?
No, not at all. I mean, I compare a relationship with God to a relationship with a good friend. If you're in need, it's unnatural not to ask someone for help. So I think petitionary prayer is a noble way of praying. But it can't be the only way that you relate to God, because that's kind of a, you know, it's sort of a one-way street, basically. But I think it's natural and human. And, you know, Jesus in the Our Father says, "Give us this day our daily bread." And that's, you know, you're asking for something. So I think it's an essential part of prayer.
Speaking of daily bread, vow of poverty doesn't mean you have to starve. And you begin a section talking about the vow of poverty by talking about a splendid dinner once in a Jesuit house.
Yes, the most famous Jesuit joke about poverty is about the young novice who's brought into a Jesuit community on the Feast of St. Ignatius, which is our big patronal feast, and he sees the tables laid out and filet mignon on the plate and beautiful flowers, and he says, "If this is poverty, bring on chastity." So, and, you know, we tell that against ourselves. Our vow of poverty is supposed to be complete. And, you know, we don't own things individually. We own things in common. We live on a very simple budget. But, you know, we're not supposed to be as I say in the book, twig-eating, cave-dwelling hermits. It's a sensible simplicity. Mm-hmm. And in the book, I talk about the value of living simply, basically. I mean, there's a whole magazine, I think, still about that. And the Jesuits have been doing it for 450 years. So I think living simply means freeing yourself up from things you don't need. And ultimately, that leads to happiness.
Father Martin, I don't have the nerve to ask you about sex, so I'm going to ask you about
chastity. Oh, feel free.
Well, I'm going to ask you about chastity.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Well, the same thing, I guess.
Well, you've got a section in here where you explain how you believe the vow of chastity makes for a better priest.
Well, yeah, chastity is not for everyone. And I think that most people tend to define it negatively, i.e. chastity means not having sex. But I define it positively, and I say that chastity means loving many people very deeply and very freely. Mm-hmm. And people feel free with a person who's chaste, really, because they know that you're not being friends with them or being close to them just for sex.
I have to present you with, the argument that I think many people feel deeply about, particularly in recent years, that that priestly celibacy has been harmful, and not just for the priest. It's resulted in priests behaving criminally, and how many thousands of priests we don't really know sexually assaulting children.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that that's more related to people who are psychologically unhealthy and also, you know, bishops who have moved priests around. That's not directly related to chastity. I don't think, you know, celibacy and chastity do not cause pedophilia, no more than, you know, I mean, most sexual abuse goes on within families, no more than marriage causes sexual abuse. So I think that there's no real cause and effect relationship.
Father Martin, I've saved, I think, almost the hardest question in life for last. If there is a God, why do little children suffer?
That is the hardest question, and I think the answer is we don't know. There are no satisfying answers for that. However, for the Christian, there is the person of Christ who has gone through suffering himself and who understands our suffering. And I think for the person who feels alone, that can be extremely consoling. But in confronting suffering, I think everyone has to come to a sort of meaning for themselves. So part of the book talks about how to find meaning for yourself through prayer and through meditation on Scripture and through the perspectives that that our belief traditions give us. But, you know, really, Scott, the best answer to that question is we don't know. And can we believe in a God whose ways that we don't understand? And I think the answer is yes.
James Martin of the Society of Jesus, Associate Editor of America Magazine, and he has a new book, The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything, A Spirituality for Real Life. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You can read an excerpt from Father Martin's book at our website, npr.org. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.